words, as I have done repeatedly since I woke up, as I must have done somewhere in my subconscious all night. Jealous rage. Spurned lover. I won't allow myself to think beyond that. I have my imagination on a tight rein. Just those words are permitted. Jealous rage. Spurned lover. Then an abrupt stop to all thought. Severine should be here now, gloating, that smirk hovering millimeters from her mouth. But for once, she's conspicuous by her absence. Jealous rage. Spurned lover. It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter. But here I am, in a grab handbag, brush hair, that will do kind of hurry, on my way to Tom's flat, which Tom entirely anticipated. It's surprising how little surprises Tom. Tom's flat is in a quiet, wealthy street, lined with Regency townhouses, all high ceilings and sash windows and expensive heating bills. I press the bell for the top floor, and after a moment, there is an obnoxious buzz, and the front door releases. The communal hallway is on a dignified slide into genteel shabbiness, the once thick carpets now worn in the centre from years of use. I climb the creaking stairs to find Tom's front door ajar. I can see a 2-inch-wide slice of his hallway, with a newspaper dumped casually on a side table. I can't quite remember the last time I was here. Actually, I can't remember being here more than 3 or 4 times, and always with a crowd, for a party or some such. Rapping on the door solo, I feel an unexpected twinge of nerves. "In the kitchen," calls Tom's deep tone. He has expelled some of the gravel now. I close the front door behind me, then aim for Tom's voice, and find myself spilling into an open-plan room, with the kitchen at one end, a living room-type space at the other, and a large glass dining table separating the two. At the living space end, floor-to-ceiling windows open out onto a small terrace. Tom is at the stove in the kitchen, working on something in a frying pan. "I don't remember this," I say, making my way over to him. I may have only been in this flat a handful of times, but I've never been in this room. He pulls me in for a one-armed hug, the other hand occupied with a frying pan, which contains the world's largest Spanish omelette. "I remodeled before I went to Boston, just in time for a tenant to enjoy it instead of me. Do you like?" he asks casually, but I can see he cares about my answer. "It's great," I say truthfully. It's modern without being sharp. It still feels warm and livable. Unlike Caro's place. Unlike Caro. "You've done it really well." A gesture toward the hob. "Can I help?" It's not the question I want to ask, but I don't know how to get there from discussions of renovations in a sun-drenched kitchen. "Nope, nearly done. Just grab a pew," he says, gesturing to the bar stools on the other side of the counter. "I take it omelette is okay?" "Perfect, thanks." I clamber aboard a stool and watch the back of him cook, given the layout of the kitchen. He can't be long out of the shower. His hair is still wet. He's wearing jeans and a casual shirt with the sleeves rolled up. For no reason at all I see Seb alongside him. Seb as he was. The Adonis. The man among the boys. I don't know the Seb of now. Jealous rage. Spurned lover. Tom, a man now too, glances over his shoulder with a quick smile. I instinctively look away quickly, as if caught staring. "Done," he says, efficiently cutting the omelette in two and delivering it to waiting plates. "Voila! Merci bien." I pause. I force myself to ask something conversational. "Do you like cooking?" He settles himself on the bar stool next to me. "Not particularly, but I like eating fresh food, so..." He shrugs his shoulders. "The omelette is good. Very good. We munch away, or at least Tom does. My appetite is letting me down. I've eaten with Tom any number of times, though never at his kitchen counter by his own hand. But still, There should be companionable silence. There always has been for Tom and me. Not today. Something is different. We are different. I glance over in his direction. He looks tired, the crinkles round his eyes more pronounced. Perhaps he is paler. His freckles seem to stand out more.
So, he says, between bites, Lara and Modan? Is that for real?
I grimace. Well, she certainly seems smitten, I say apologetically. I wonder if that question has itched away at him all night.
Yeah, that much was obvious.
There's no emotion in his voice. He takes a bite and chews thoughtfully, staring unseeingly across the kitchen.
It's not ideal.
Not ideal? It's an oddly phlegmatic turn of phrase for heartbreak.
I guess, on any number of fronts.
I put down my fork, unable to eat and unable to wait, and twist on the barstool to face his profile.
What did you mean last night?
He turns to look at me, his head cocked to one side analytically. Then he lays his cutlery down too, but he's actually finished, the enormous omelette polished off in a handful of bites. He knows exactly what I'm referring to, and to his credit he doesn't try to dissemble.
Severine was an attractive girl, he says carefully.
I nod and wonder where she is. Surely she wouldn't want to miss out on this conversation.
Modan seems to find it hard to believe that none of us was sleeping with her. He's playing a what-if game right now. What if, well, what if Tom was sleeping with Severine? But that's unlikely because everyone knows I hooked up with Lara that week, and Modan clearly thinks Lara is more than enough for one man to cope with.
His tone is heavy with irony. He pauses for a moment. I can't tell if he's remembering the past or looking to the future. But regardless, it seems the view is bleak.
But what if Seb was sleeping with Severine? Well, that would certainly make things interesting.
He stops, holding my gaze. The question that we both know I'm going to ask hangs in the air between us, solid enough to reach out and touch. I want to know, I say quietly.
Tom looks away and runs a hand through his hair. Then fixes me in his gaze again.
Do you really care?
There's an edge to his voice. After all this time?
10 years have passed since that week in France. 10 years and a bloody marriage ceremony.
I care about whether I was made a fool of.
I sound bitter. I feel bitter and impatient.
I care about whether all my friends knew what was going on under my nose but didn't tell me.
So it's all about pride.
Yes. No. I don't know. Look, was he fucking her or not?
Yes, he says simply. I open my mouth to say something, but nothing comes to mind. I close it again. Pride, I think. Tom is right on that score. My pride is well and truly hurt. Severine has finally made her entrance. She's watching me from across the kitchen, and my fingers curl in an urge to drag my nails down those perfectly smooth cheeks, an urge so strong that I almost recoil from myself. The poor girl is dead. No one can possibly feel envious of her ever again. She watches me, and I fancy she knows what I'm thinking. She looks coolly to the side, as if utterly uninterested in my opinion. Tom is watching me too. His brow furrowed in concern. I start to slide down from the barstool.
No, says Tom assertively, bringing me up short by grabbing my arm. You don't get to disappear now. You wanted to know, so you have to listen to it all instead of building up all sorts of crazy scenarios in your head.
His eyes are fiercely intent.
Kate, this is not some conspiracy theory. Nobody has been whispering behind your back. It was a one-time thing, on the last night only. Hardly anyone knows about it. Seb doesn't even know that I know about it.
I process that for a moment, fighting my urge to flee. The last night.
After the fight, then? He nods. His grip loosens on my upper arm. Instead, he rubs his hand reassuringly up and down from my shoulder to my elbow. The last night, after the fight. You said hardly anyone. Who else?
I don't know for sure, he says uneasily. But maybe... Caro.
Caro, of course. It would have to be Caro. Of all people, it would have to be her. I bet she has loved having that piece of knowledge secreted away, ready to be deployed at just the right moment for maximum personal advantage. I can just imagine how superior it has made her feel. I find my hands have clawed. I force myself to breathe out slowly and relax them.
How do you know about it, then?
I saw them, he admits. I don't know for sure, but I think Caro did too, or at least she put two and two together. I can see him gauging my reaction, trying to work out if each additional detail makes things better or worse, but nevertheless, he's unflinching in his delivery. He releases my arm and runs his hand through his hair again instead. He looks as if, on balance, he'd much rather not have seen. What did he see exactly? I steel myself for the malevolent march of that thought eating away at me, the rot spreading at a steady rate until I can see nothing without an overlay of Seb and Severine in various different tangles of limbs, artfully backlit Hollywood style. But a thoroughly unexpected dose of pragmatism hits me. The last night of the holiday? That famously eventful Friday night? Logistically, it couldn't have happened until after the fight, at which point Seb was already so drunk that, at some point when I have some perspective, I may be impressed that he managed to cheat on me at all. I'm fairly certain there was no cinematic glow involved that night. But...
How do you know it wasn't happening all week, and you just didn't see it the other times?
Come on, he says, one eyebrow quirking upward. We're talking about Seb. Subtlety and subterfuge have never been his strongest suits.
I don't react. He sighs, then looks at me searchingly, all humor gone.
Did you never wonder? Not even when the two of you broke up?
I shake my head, but we both know I'm lying.
Why did you think you broke up? Christ, Tom! Can anyone ever answer that succinctly? Why did you and Jenna break up?
I counter. He doesn't miss a beat, and he doesn't break eye contact.
Because I didn't love her. Not the way I want to love whoever I'm going to spend the rest of my life with.
His starkly brutal honesty leaves me speechless, caught in the grip of his ferociously intent eyes. Like Seb's, but not. Now all I can see are the differences, not the similarities. I'm still groping around for a response, when suddenly his phone starts to ring and dance across the counter. He glances at it long enough to register the caller ID, then picks it up and grimaces apologetically.
Sorry, I've got to take this. It's work. Don't go away.
I slide off the stool and wander into the living area of the open-plan space. Why did I think Seb and I broke up? I glance back at Tom. He's roaming the kitchen as he listens, his tall frame telegraphing alertness and focus. I turn back to the living room, inspecting the few framed photos resting on a shelf. There's one of him with his parents and his younger sister on his graduation day. His dad has clapped his hand firmly on Tom's shoulder and is beaming proudly. A wave of longing for my own father crashes over me, taking my breath away with its sudden onslaught. I turn quickly to the next photo. Seb and Tom, at perhaps 15 years old, beside a sailing boat with a gentleman that can only be Seb's father. The whippet-thin figure of Tom is a step back and half-turned, as if he was about to get into the boat when the photo was taken. Seb's father's hand is on his shoulder, tugging him into the photo. Seb is square to the camera on his father's other side, smiling broadly. It's not a version of Seb I ever knew.
He was more complete when I met him. More of a polished product. I look at that photo for a long time and think about all the different versions of Seb, including the one that cheated on me. The bitterness is an all-encompassing sea of bile, roiling around in my stomach and threatening to race up my throat to choke me. Why did I think Seb and I broke up? I'm so very, very tired of caring. Tom has moved from receiving mode into delivery mode on his telephone call. No, I don't actually, I hear him say authoritatively. The basis risk on this structure is significant. Someone has to take it, and if it's going to be us, then we have to charge for it. But the real problem is that this is the wrong structure for what they really want to do. We should get in front of them with a presentation and educate them. I find I'm watching him as he talks. He's still moving around the kitchen, his right hand accentuating his points. For a moment, I find myself assessing him as I would any candidate that crossed the path of Channing Associates. It dawns on me that he's a fixer, a problem solver, entirely in keeping with his degree in engineering, but somehow, I've never paid attention to this side of him. He feels my eyes upon him and looks across, mouthing what could be 2 minutes, whilst holding up two fingers. I nod and make a show of turning unconcernedly to another photo, and find myself looking back at me. I'm not the only one in the photo, of course. There's Tom next to me, and Lara on his other side. We're all sitting on the side of the pool in France, our feet dangling in the water. Lara is almost spilling out of her bikini, and looks how she always looks, as if she's just climbed out of bed after hours of languorous sex, but would be more than willing to tumble back in for another round. Tom is Tom, at least the Tom I know the best, relaxed, laid back, secure in his own skin, but quietly observant. I'm the Kate I like the least, awkwardly folding my arms across my stomach at the glimpse of a camera, a half-hearted smile hung on my face. It's not surprising. There was no heart in any of my smiles by the end of that week. Suddenly I realize Tom is behind me, looking over my shoulder at the photo. I hadn't noticed him finish the call. Cracking legs you have on display there, he says mischievously. I smile, touched. It's gentlemanly of him to comment on me, rather than the bombshell that is Lara. I gesture toward the sailing photo. Did you sail a lot growing up? It's the only non-contentious thing I can think of to say. He shrugs. Uncle Edwin was really into it. He taught Seb and me. He looks at the photo a moment longer. Did you know he paid all my school fees before I got the scholarship? Uncle Edwin, Lord Harcourt. I shake my head. I didn't. I think about that for a moment. The younger sister and her penniless academic husband living off the generosity of the Lord in the grand house. I guess that must have created a certain dynamic. He glances down at me. No, it was, he starts to say, as if parroting the party line. Then he stops. Actually, yeah, he admits. My folks never said anything, but I could see how relieved they were when I won the scholarship. He looks back at the photo. But it was a bit awkward with Seb since he just missed out. But you two never seemed competitive with each other, I say, confused. He shrugs. Seb likes to win. Before I can try to puzzle that out, he shakes himself and turns away from the photos. Anyway, where were we? Nowhere I want to go back to. His lips twist apologetically. I'm sorry I didn't tell you before. Don't be ridiculous, Seb is your family. I can't blame Tom in the slightest for keeping Seb's secrets. I can blame Seb for having them, though. I can and I do. Yes, but, well anyway, you wanted to know. He cocks his head and assesses me, lips pursed. How do you feel now you do? I turn away, scrubbing my face with my hands. God, I don't know. It's hard to find perspective. Does Tom think I'm taking this well or badly? Should I be more upset or less upset? Exactly how upset am I? What is the proportionate response when discovering decade-old infidelity? Kate, he says, a little too loudly, as if he said my name more than once. Maybe he has. I turn back toward him, eyebrows raised inquiringly. They're going to try and pin this on one of us, he says quietly. Theo's dad says there's been a lot of publicity on this case in France. The police are getting hauled over the coals in the press for not finding the body at the time. There's a lot of pressure on them to get a result. But it wasn't one of us. I sound like a child, railing against the injustice of life. It's not fair. But life isn't fair, he will say. I know that. After irrevocably losing Seb and my dad in close succession, albeit in different ways, I couldn't fail to recognize that life lacks a sense of fair play. Tom doesn't even bother to argue the point. He's already moved on. I think you need to get a lawyer. A lawyer? I stare at him. You're serious? He nods grimly. Do you have one? Nope. But my other half wasn't sleeping with a girl who subsequently turned up folded origami style at the bottom of a well. I can see her bleached skull grinning maniacally from the pinnacle of a pile of clean white bones. My breath catches. Well, when you put it like that, Modane, the French police, they will put it like that. But they don't know he and she. Ah. Tom is nodding. Yes, Caro. I don't know for sure that she knows, and I don't know if she would say anything, but... He spreads his fingers palm up. I know he intends to convey uncertainty. She might not. But I know the truth of it. She will. Unless there's some personal benefit to her that I haven't yet divined, without a doubt, Caro will say something. If she hasn't already. I stare at him, my mind skittering on many levels. They need hard evidence to prosecute, right? It can't be purely circumstantial. He shrugs. I'm not exactly an expert in the French criminal judiciary system. Me neither. Which, at present, seems a wholly unsatisfactory gap in my legal education. Eventually I say again, so a lawyer. You're serious? Yes. There isn't a shadow of doubt in his eyes. Okay then. I'm still staring at him, my mind whirring. And stop talking to Lara about the case, he presses. Yes. Okay. He's still looking at me as if waiting for more. So I say it again. Okay. He nods and lets out a breath. Okay. I take a cab home. I can't face the bustle and thrust of the tube. I'm too brittle. I may fracture if jostled. The cab driver tries to start up a conversation, but trails off into silence when I fail to offer a single response. Lara's name lights up the screen on my mobile as we drive, the shrill ringtone demanding a response. I look at the phone in my hand, and all I can see are spider's threads leading from it. Lara to Alain Modane. Lara to Tom. Tom to Seb, his own cousin. Tom and Seb to Caro, their friend from childhood. Tom and Seb to Theo, their friend from university. Theo to Severine. Severine to Seb. Tug on any one thread, and the reverberations will be felt by all. The phone falls silent. I don't call her back. Chapter 9. By Monday, Severine has found an additional medium through which to make her presence felt. Print. The case is making enough waves in France to be worthy of several column inches in the European news section of the Telegraph. There's a political angle I don't fully comprehend, not being an expert on French politics over the last 10 years. Another unsatisfactory gap in my knowledge base. They have a picture of Severine. Of course they do. She is nothing if not photogenic, especially in a bikini, as in the chosen photo. She lounges unsmiling in black and white on a sunbed, looking at the camera with no trace of concern about being framed on all sides by the words that attempt to capture her life and death, and the chaos left by both. Channing Associates is in the press too. Paul comes into the office, a perfect storm of tailored suit, energy and enthusiasm, waving a copy of Legal Week. He pulls up his calendar as I take the paper off him to read it. It's a good article. Apparently, despite being newly established, Channing Associates, headed up by Kate Channing, is comprised of experienced hands who are fleet of foot. And are the team to watch.
I reckon I can lobby Cadfield's again on the back of this publicity, Paul is saying. They kind of left the door open. I'll try them. And then there's Winterson's. And I heard about an in-house general counsel role at BP from a mate at...
He babbles away. The Haft and Weil win has given him renewed vigour beyond all expectation. I wonder if he's further up the bipolar curve than most. I put Legal Week down on my desk, next to Severine. One article where I'm mentioned by name, one where I'm simply one of the English holidaymakers staying in the neighbouring farmhouse at the time, who are helping the police with their inquiries. It's not an even match. Severine continues to gaze from her sun lounger, and I can think of nothing else. I need a lawyer, which ought to be funny given I'm a legal headhunter. Except that it's not funny at all. Because I need a lawyer. Mordan again. He's waiting for me when I emerge from Pret, clutching my coffee and my lunch in a bag. I stop short in the doorway when I spot him lounging against a lamppost.
Bonjour,
he greets me, inclining his head. I sigh and start walking.
Bonjour.
I'm afraid I don't have any time for you today. And I don't have a lawyer yet. He falls in beside me and shrugs.
Surely a few minutes?
Not really, I'm afraid.
Perhaps I talk and you listen, while you are eating your lunch, no?
I'm walking back to my office, but it occurs to me that he will very likely follow me all the way there. I definitely do not want Paul and Julie exposed to the charming Alain Mordan, and the no-doubt innocent-sounding questions that he would produce. I stop walking and look at him. He cocks his head and smiles his most beguiling smile, the deep lines in his long face curving to frame his mouth. I'll listen. That's it. I take a detour toward a nearby courtyard with a bench that will be in the sun, if there's any sun. It's warm enough today to justify eating outside. The bench is empty. I navigate to it carefully, given that cobblestones, a cup of coffee and kitten heels are a difficult mix. But I make it there unscathed and sit at one end, with my coffee placed precariously on the arm of the bench. Mordan sits also, at the far end, spreading his arms along the back of the bench. The sun makes an unexpected appearance, and he tips his head back to enjoy it, eyes closed. Today he's wearing a pale pink shirt under his suit, with a silver-grey tie. Very Eurotrash. But it works for him. I wonder if he looks at my clothes in abject horror. This dress is probably 2 years old. At least I'm wearing designer shoes.
Hello,
he says, pulling himself upright into business mode. I'm unpackaging my chicken wrap, and pay him no heed.
So, I talk. As promised. We have the answer on when the well was filled in.
He looks at me expectantly. I remember that I'm not supposed to know this, and raise my eyebrows obligingly over my mouthful of wrap.
Saturday, the 16th.
Having a mouthful is useful. It gives me time to think. About what to say, how to say it, about whether to say anything at all.
You said Friday before. Now you say Saturday.
I comment mildly when I'm done chewing.
What makes you so sure you've got it right this time?
He inclines his head, a silent touché.
The papers say Friday, but Monsieur Castor, the younger one, tells me it was Saturday. He remembers that his girlfriend arrived in town unexpectedly, so they went off to...
He spreads his hands eloquently.
He came back on Saturday to finish the job.
He looks at me again, as if waiting for a comment, but when he sees I have another mouthful, he goes on, with a wry twist to his lips.
He wrote down Friday on the paperwork because of the contract. There was a bonus if the work was finished on time. On Friday. You see?
I do see why Mordan believes Monsieur Castor the Younger. Even I believe this, and I'm hearing it second-hand.
Does Theo's dad plan to sue him for return of the bonus? I ask, tongue-in-cheek.
Mordan's lips quirk.
I don't believe he considers it a high priority.
He gives this last word the French pronunciation, priorité. I take another mouthful and chew thoughtfully. Saturday, the day we left. Mordan tips his head back to enjoy another brief appearance of the sun. I try to nudge the conversation forward when I have finally swallowed.
What time on Saturday?
He's been waiting for this. For him, this is all a game that he's very, very good at. He tips his head forward again and blinks a few times while his eyes adjust.
He doesn't remember exactly, but he thinks perhaps lunchtime?
Lunchtime. Severine would have had plenty of time to return from the bus depot, and then... What? Get herself killed by person or persons unknown, and stuffed in a well? My breath catches. It's not a game. I don't want to play. I put down my suddenly very unappetizing chicken wrap.
I presume you've considered Monsieur Castor, I say in a rush, younger or elder.
Bien sûr, of course.
He purses his lips and moves his head this way and that, as if trying to look at something from different angles.
They do not seem to... fit.
And neither do the rest of us.
I can't hide my frustration. He gives an equivocal one-shoulder shrug. I stand up to dump my leftovers in a nearby bin, annoyed with myself as well as Mordan. I have no lawyer. I shouldn't be here. I pick up my handbag and my as-yet untouched coffee. Mordan watches me gather myself together without getting up, his long arms still laid across the back of the bench, the very picture of relaxed elegance.
Stranger danger, he muses. That is what you say, n'est-ce pas? That is what you teach les enfants at school? For murder, it is most of the time... bof. Most of the time it is rubbish. Most of the time the murderer is in the home, or the street, or the place of work.
Someone nearby. Someone known.
Thanks for that, I say sweetly. On that cheery note, I must get back to work to spend the rest of the day in fear of my colleagues and neighbours.
Ha!
He seems genuinely amused by this. His long face is split by his smile.
Have a good afternoon.
But I don't have a good afternoon. I have a busy afternoon, even a productive afternoon. I have an afternoon that in the ordinary course of events would be a perfectly fine afternoon, but not in this world, not after these events, not with the shadow of Mordan looming over me and the ghost of Severine flitting through my office at will. Carol calls. I get Julie to take a message. She'll be calling about either Seb's welcome dinner or to pump me for information, likely both, and I have no energy for either. I meet Lara for a drink after work. Investigation or no investigation, I can't avoid my closest friend. I can't remember ever deliberately keeping something from Lara. Seb cheated on me with Severine. The words beat around inside me, looking for an exit, but I force them down. Denied escape, they become a solid, ever-present weight that sits in my stomach. But Lara doesn't notice anything amiss. She's too busy keeping her own secrets. She doesn't ask me if I've seen Modan. She doesn't ask me anything about the case. She's trying far too hard to avoid the subject. I wonder whether she's seen him, or talked to him on the phone. I wonder whether they have put into action those desires whispered in an airport bar. The weight in my stomach grows heavier as we talk of all the things we usually talk of, which no longer matter at all.
"Oh, Caro called me,"
she says suddenly, wrinkling her pretty nose in distaste.
"She's got that dinner she's been planning for Seb arranged for Thursday."
She cocks her head and looks at me pleadingly.
"Will you come, please?"
Will I? I hadn't intended to go, but now I think about it.
I suppose so.
I'm bound to run into Seb sooner or later. I may as well get it over with.
Yay! It will be no fun without you, and Caro kind of forced me to say yes. She'll probably put the full court press on you, too, at some point.
You know, she muses, much as I hate to admit it, it is nice of her to have arranged it all. I bet Seb will be really touched. She takes a sip from her wine, then asks hesitantly, in an almost word-perfect repeat of Tom's question on Saturday, "Do you still care, after all this time?" I look at our half-drunk wine glasses, Lara's with a distinct lipstick smudge on one side, mine with only the merest suggestion of a lip print. In my darkly introspective mood, even that seems highly symbolic, a deliberate motif designed to illustrate that I move through life, leaving barely a trace to show I was ever there. "I don't know," I reply at last. I think of Tom's follow-up. "Why did you think you broke up?" And I see Seb's eyes when he told me it was over. I see the way they slid away from mine. I thought that underneath it all he felt guilty, for a myriad of reasons, but one particular being he was ashamed that for all his assertions that background didn't matter. In the end he had to acknowledge that he wanted someone from his world, someone who fit. Now I have a different thesis about the source of that guilt, though not one I can share with Lara. It's hard to say. I haven't actually seen him since, well, since he dumped me, actually. Lara's eyes widen.
Really? Not once? How can that be?
I shrug. I guess I didn't want to see him at first, and then Dad got ill, so I was up in Yorkshire for a bit. It was cancer. Pancreatic cancer. I pause, remembering the phone call from Mum, the hopelessness in her voice as she forced herself to utter the dreaded C-word, followed by the mad dash to get the very next train home. I cried silently for almost the entire 3-hour journey, sitting alone in a quiet seat facing a luggage rack. By the time I got to the hospital, I was ash white and out of tears. Anyway, by the time I came back, his bank had sent him off to Singapore or somewhere like that. Hong Kong, I think. Tom and Caro went to visit. She takes another sip of her wine, laying down another mark of her presence with an overlapping lipstick print. Makes it kind of hard to find closure if you've never actually seen him since. She uses her hands to hang an ironic set of quotation marks around closure, and gives the word an American twang. "Closure," I repeat, mimicking her twang. "Closure." I take a long swallow from my glass, then try the word again in my own accent, rolling it around my mouth. "Closure." I shake my head. "Nope. Word has absolutely no meaning." She giggles. "I think you're too British for the concept of closure. Or too northern. We don't grin and bear it. We just bear it and don't bother with the grin. We Scandies don't bear it at all. We just off ourselves." We smile at each other, enjoying the connection and the levity, and the weight in my stomach lifts a little. It will be all right, I think. When all this is over, everything will be all right again. The feeling lasts until I climb into a cab home to find Severine already in occupation. The sight of her is like a slap in the face, or a brutal thump back down to earth. It shocks the sense back into me. All right. What an appallingly trite sentiment. It won't be all right, at least not for everyone. How could I have temporarily forgotten? I've long stopped believing in guaranteed happy endings. There was a time with Seb where what I felt for him, what I thought he felt for me, was like a rising tide, buoying me up over all obstacles. The inevitable crash when the tide abruptly receded was shattering, all the more so because I should have known better, because I did know better. Oxford was an education in more ways than one. I learned that like sticks with like. Bright, outspoken girls from underprivileged backgrounds might be fun to hang out with, but they don't ultimately make the inner sanctum of the Sebs of this world. Somehow, even knowing that, even in the face of all evidence to the contrary, I allowed myself to be fooled into believing our relationship would be different, that things would be all right. I won't be a fool again. I won't allow it. I need a damn lawyer.
8 o'clock tonight, says Caro
emphatically down the phone on Thursday afternoon. Julie rang her earlier in the week to confirm my attendance, but it's clear Caro isn't taking any chances.
I know this is, well, difficult for you, but I won't accept any last-minute excuses. After all, Bordarello's is hell to get a table at.
Her tone is carefully constructed to sound like a light-hearted tease mixed with sympathy. But Caro is not that kind of girl. She doesn't gossip and sympathize and commiserate. She pokes and prods under the cover of witty repartee.
Of course I'll be there, I say calmly. I'm looking forward to it.
For a moment I entertain the fantasy of turning up with an adoring Adonis on my arm. Who? Where would he come from at such late notice? But I'll have to settle for Lara and Tom. Perhaps the Adonis trick would be too obvious anyway.
It'll be great to have the old gang back together, she says brightly. Like old times.
Old times? The thought makes me shudder. Caro's old times must be very different from mine. I try to strip the irony from any potential response, but she's already forging on.
That's all I seem to be talking about these days, what with the investigation and everything. Modan can't seem to stop with the questions, can he? Have you seen him too?
Not really. He dropped by on Monday, but I was too busy to have more than 5 minutes for him.
I made the mistake of freeing up half an hour for him. I don't know what for, really. All he wanted to talk about was who was sleeping with who, and whether anyone was sleeping with Severine.
Well, I certainly wasn't, I say flippantly. Girls have never been my thing. What about you? She gives what may be a genuine laugh.
No, me neither. I'm boringly bourgeois that way. But seriously, I suppose it changes things a bit if someone was sleeping with her.
How so? I ask, making my voice as uninterested as possible. Does she really know about Seb and Severine? Is she trying to find out if I know? Does she know that I know that she knows that?
Motive, I suppose. Crime of passion or some such thing. God, I sound like CSI.
She laughs it off.
It's all a bit grubby, really, having a stranger like Modan pouring eagerly through all our tangled love lives.
She switches gear audibly.
Anyway, tonight, 8 o'clock, Bordarello's.
See you there. I put down the phone, her words turning over in my head. Our tangled love lives. I was with Seb, Lara was with Tom. Other than Seb's infidelity, where lies the tangle? Come to that, Carol wasn't with anyone. Why would she say our love lives? I start to run the payroll software that I use to manage Julie's and Paul's salaries, but I'm too distracted to make sense of the process. Abruptly, I shut down the program and grab my phone.
Kate, hello.
Tom sounds harried. Bad time. I glance at the clock. It's 10 to 3.
Oh shit, sorry, it's almost expiry time.
Foreign exchange options usually expire at 3.
Yup, can I call you back after?
Sure. He pauses.
You okay?
Yes, fine, it's nothing. Call me back later. My voice sounds too bright, too forced.
Okay.
I put down my mobile and stare at it for a moment. Then I shake myself and open the payroll software again with grim determination. It's sufficiently alien that to make any progress, I have to concentrate to the exclusion of anything else. It's curiously calming. When my mobile finally rings, I'm startled.
Kate?
It's Tom. The real world floods back in and temporarily robs me of breath.
Kate, can you hear me?
He asks.
Yes, sorry, I'm here. Everything okay?
Yes.
Actually, no. Was Seb sleeping with anyone else? What?
He's genuinely taken aback.
Where's this coming from?
It's just something Caro said. I wondered... I feel a cold sweat on my torso. It's excruciatingly embarrassing to have to ask this. It's embarrassing to even have to wonder it. In time, I will feel anger at Seb for putting me in this position. But all I feel at the moment is shame.
Hold on a moment. This sounds like something I shouldn't be broadcasting over the trading floor. Let me get to my office.
There's a pause and some muffled noises. Then he comes back on the line.
Fire away.
It's just, I'm probably getting the wrong end of the stick. But I wondered if Carol was sleeping with Seb. I add as an afterthought, or you, actually.
Theo, I don't consider a real possibility.
Me sleeping with Seb? He sounds genuinely bewildered.
I can't help but laugh.
No, with Carol, you idiot.
Hand on my heart, I can promise you I have never slept with either Seb or Caro, nor do I have any wish to.
Humor warms his deep voice. And Seb?
Seb with Caro, to be precise.
His pause is significant.
I don't think so, he says finally. There's no trace of the humor now. I think, well, Caro has always had a thing for him. You must know that.
I suppose he's right. I've always known that. And?
And nothing. I think that's all it's ever been, an unrequited thing. He kind of knew it, but I don't think he ever went there. He never felt the same, and it would have been a disaster given how close all our families are if he were to screw her over.
Of course it was fine to screw me over with my unconnected, unimportant family.
At least, that's my take, he says at last.
But I get the sense he's still mulling something over.
Would he have told you, do you think? I know you're close, but he didn't tell you about Severine.
True. I hear him take a breath in, then blow it out.
I don't know, he admits reluctantly. Before you came along, then I'd have said yes, for sure, he would have told me anything. But after... I don't know.
I want to ask what changed, but there's no way to do it without sounding like I'm looking for some validation, some sign I was important in Seb's life, and I refuse to be so pitiful in front of Tom.
Where are you going with this?
I don't know. I just suddenly feel like... God, I don't know. I don't know what the hell was going on that week. Mordan is asking questions, and I'm not even sure I can answer anything. Because nothing is how I thought it was, and... I'm suddenly aware I'm close to tears.
Hey, whoa there, Tom says softly down the line. It's okay.
No, it's not.
He's silent for a moment. No, it's not, is it?
Look, why don't we meet before dinner tonight? Have a drink and talk all this through. I can get to Knightsbridge for around 6, okay? I take a deep, shuddering breath. Yes, okay, thanks. Sorry about all this. You have nothing to be sorry for. Oh, did you get a lawyer?
I'm meeting one tomorrow.
Good. He sounds genuinely relieved. See you at 6. I put down the phone and rest my eye sockets in the heels of my hands for a moment. When I lift my head again, I find Severine watching me. For once, there's no trace of hostility beneath her smooth exterior. She's simply watching me.
Haven't you anywhere better to be?
I ask her. It's the first time I've actually spoken to her. Unsurprisingly, she doesn't answer, so I do it for her.
No, I don't suppose you do, under the circumstances.
Julie comes to the doorway, pushing her glasses back up her nose.
Did you need something?
I shake my head, smiling brightly.
No, sorry, just talking to myself.
She's already moving back to her seat.
First sign of madness, you know,
she says over her shoulder. The thought had crossed my mind. Chapter 10. The evening starts badly. I'm at the pub a few minutes after 6, and predictably find Tom, reliable, steady Tom, already there, but so too is Lara. From Tom's ruefully apologetic expression, I divine he had no choice. I pull myself together to kiss Lara hello.
What a pleasant surprise.
I was sure you'd want to meet beforehand, but I couldn't raise you on your mobile this afternoon, so I called Tom, she says breezily.
Really? My phone must be playing up again. I didn't see that you'd called.
Lying is becoming easier with practice, but the guilt remains the same. I turn to hug Tom hello. His breath strokes my ear, carrying a murmur of, sorry. He's been home to change after work. He's dressed in jeans and a shirt, and smells of newly applied aftershave. I'm still in work clothes, but it's a deliberate choice. I have a fancy that the combination of this dress, with these stiletto heels, shows off my legs to their best advantage. Absent the Adonis arm candy, it's really the best I can do.
Here, Tom got you a drink.
Lara passes over a vodka tonic.
Thanks. Love your dress.
It occurs to me that I'm overcompensating, though she does look fabulous. She's wearing a stunning bodycon dress the color of autumn leaves, with heels at least an inch higher than her usual choice for work. Most of the bar watches as she settles herself in a chair and crosses her endless legs.
Well, I thought I'd make an effort,
she says casually, but there are spots of colour in her cheeks. The effort is not for me or Tom, or even Caro or Seb, I'm sure. I'd lay odds she has post-dinner plans with the indefatigable Monsieur Modan.
What about me? How do I look?
Tom asks, mock preening. He's compensating too. Lara bats her eyelashes at him.
Devastatingly handsome as ever.
Very metrosexual, I add slyly.
He turns to me, appreciative laughter glinting in those blue-grey eyes. They are resolutely Tom's eyes now. I wonder if this evening will shake that. We drink and we talk, and it's excruciating. Lara is too bright, too excitable, drinking too quickly. It's impossible to fathom what's going on under the surface, and given the secrets each of us are keeping, there's no way for me to ask. Subterfuge doesn't sit well with her, though. She ricochets through topics, always realizing each pitfall too late. She can't talk about her love life. She can't talk about the case. She can't talk about how she's spending her free time. Almost nothing is safe for her. I'm so awkwardly aware this is not the private chat Tom and I had planned, that I'm working too hard to keep the conversation Lara-friendly and save her from verbal suicide. On the surface, Tom is his usual relaxed self, complete with mildly flirtatious banter with Lara, but I can see he's uncharacteristically tense and oddly fatalistic, as if waiting for an axe to drop rather than killing time before a homecoming dinner for his cousin and closest friend. Perhaps he, too, can see that the light within Lara is shining for someone other than her current audience. I wonder how much that pierces him. It's hard enough to battle on with this charade whilst sober. I shouldn't have another vodka tonic. But I do. And another. Finally, Lara glances at her watch. Shouldn't we make tracks before we incur the wrath of Caro? I nod and reach for my handbag, partly relieved to be released, but I expect what's coming will be worse. Tom knocks back the remainder of his pint and deposits the glass on the table with an audible thump. Out of the frying pan, into the fire, he murmurs darkly. I look across at him in surprise. What does he have to be worried about now? But he's looking toward the exit. The skin round his eyes is tight with anxiety. The restaurant is a short walk away. Lara walks in the middle and links an arm through one of Tom's arms and one of mine, as if to prevent us from escaping. There's no time for even a deep breath before she has hustled me through the door into what seems more akin to a theatre dressing room than a restaurant. I busy myself leaving my coat and bag with the cloakroom attendant, both reluctant to look round and reluctant to be seen looking round. Tom hovers near me as I pass my things over, tension visible in his jaw. Are you okay? I ask him quietly, bemused. What, me, of course. He brushes it off. I'm just worried about you. I shake my head minutely as I take the ticket from the attendant. No need. If only, I think I hear him say. I look at him sharply, but I can't follow up because Caro is descending upon us. I have to manufacture a smile to endure whatever thorny welcome she will greet me with, but she's too caught up in her favourite role of hostess to deliver anything of consequence. Then there's no longer an excuse. I'm being swept inexorably toward a long table that can only be our reservation. And there is Seb. He's standing by the table, his hand on the back of a chair that's occupied by a slender blonde woman sitting sideways. He looks up on hearing the bustle of our approach, a grin spreading across his face. He is Seb. It's a shock somehow. He is still so very much Seb. Lara, bless her 1,000 times bless her, steams in ahead of me, an unstoppable force of bosom and smile and hair, all outstretched arms and double kisses. Seb, she says, in a suitably delighted tone. So good to see you, and this must be Alina. Alina stands to greet Lara. She's tall, taller than I, with the fine-boned features that somehow speak of years of pony club and expensive schooling. Her accent when she replies to Lara only confirms that. She is everything I expected she would be. Tom is following in Lara's wake, he and Seb are grinning above a manly handshake that becomes a one-armed hug, then almost descends into a boyish rough and tumble in their pleasure at seeing each other. But now Tom is switching his attention to Alina. It's my turn. Seb is waiting, smiling at me, an arm ready to steady me for the double kiss treatment. Kate, he says quietly, warmly, as I draw close. It's been too long. It hits me that there's a familiarity in the feel of that cheek, of the arm I lay my hand on as we kiss. I don't know if I expected that, after all these years. How are you? I ask, as I draw back. It's the polite thing to say under the circumstances. It's possible I'm interested in the answer, but I've resolved not to dissolve into self-analysis this evening. Tonight, I have to simply make it through. Good, great. He spreads his hands. His hair is shorter than before, and there are little flecks of grey above his ears. He's wearing jeans and a casual shirt, like almost every other male here, though though both may be more expensive than the average.
Great to be back.
He runs an appreciative eye over me.
You look well. I hear you're doing well.